Thanks for attending session 376, titled Food of the Goddess, the Entheogenic Theory of Religion. This is the closing session for Saturday. Following the session, there's going to be a linger-longer pasta dinner and evening storytelling with music, storytelling and music with Elnett Baker and Mindy Gledel, and tickets are available for purchase at the registration desk. This session is being recorded, so please turn off your phones and whatnot, remain respectful and all that. And as you leave us tonight, we want to thank you for coming and being part of the Sunstone Symposium. And you have now participated in the tradition of Mormon history that is over 40 years old. Mormonism can be what we make it, and your participation helps make Mormonism a little more diverse, interesting, and inclusive. Please support Sunstone by making a donation, subscribing to the magazine, and attending our regional conference. And you are all invited to attend our next regional conference, celebrating 500 years of the Reformation in Frankfurt, Germany, in September. You can register at sunstone.org. Also, Mormon scholars survive on your book purchases, so be sure to hit them up. This session will be 90 minutes long. We ask everybody to keep that inside so that we can all get to dinner on time. And about this presentation, what we're hearing tonight, and I'm sure you're all here because you're excited, this presentation will begin by discussing psychedelic plants like psilocybic mushrooms, mescaline cacti, ergot extract, ayahuasca, and cannabis. I wonder if there's any of that around the campus. How they affect the human brain, what the psychedelic experiences are like, and the effects they can have on people. The second half will explain the entheogenic theory of religion, a somewhat speculative explanation of how we changed from shamanic, egalitarian, peaceful goddess worshippers to patriarchal, warmongering religious dogmatists after the development of agriculture. Our presenter is Micah Nicolaisen. He spent the last 5 years in the progressive post-Mormon community as a blogger, podcaster, activist, and community organizer. He was the original host of the A Thoughtful Faith podcast, as well as one of the organizers of the Any Opposed demonstration. Now the presentation.
That's kind of an awkward transition there from the stage. I guess I better hold this. Can you guys hear me? Okay, cool. Right on. All right. So, is everybody ready to talk about drugs? I'm really excited to present about this. Talking about things like psychedelics and transcendent experiences has become kind of a hobby of mine. And so I'm excited to kind of share some of my thoughts with you and to present a very speculative theory of that perhaps the use of entheogens and psychedelics assisted in the transition from primitive, pre-agriculture, goddess-worshipping shamanic religions to, you know, what we recognize now as the modern religious movements that we see throughout the world, and whether or not that was a good thing. And so that's what we'll be talking about a little bit. But mostly, most of the time, I'm going to be talking about psychedelics. Oh, and also, there's no way this is going to go an hour and a half. I just want everybody to know that. I told Skip to cut me off at 6 for Q&A, but we'll just see what happens. Looks like we actually got a decent turnout. I mean, I don't know why they put me up against the infants, you know? Like, anyway. Okay. So a little bit about me. I know there was a brief introduction. Already mentioned that my activity in kind of the more public Mormon community has been some podcasting and some activism, and I'm also a pretty active volunteer for Sunstone. This is my 5th or my 6th Sunstone Symposium that I've been to here in Salt Lake. So it's something I look forward to every year. It's always on my calendar. In terms of my perspective and kind of my approach to Mormonism, I'm definitely an ex-Mormon. I'm a post-believer, and I am definitely would categorize myself as an agnostic atheist. That being said, because of psychedelics, I'm also a goddess worshiper. And that may or may not make any sense to some of you, but hopefully by the time my presentation is over, it will make a little bit more sense because you know, Mormons are a people of paradox anyway, right? So, and here is all my credentials for what I'm talking about here. I'm a single dad. For work, I work for a law firm. We represent injured motorcyclists. I'm not a lawyer. I also do some photography on the side, and my education constitutes an Associate of Arts degree from a from a community college in Orange County, California, and 80% of a political science degree. So that brings me to my disclaimers. I am not an expert whatsoever in any of the areas that I will pretend to know something about, all right? So that will include chemistry, biology, botany, medicine, pharmacology, neuroscience, religious history, human anthropology, and if it comes up, Mormonism. So take everything I say with a grain of salt, you know. I don't really know what the hell I'm talking about. But, you know, I do think that it is important for all of us to become kind of familiar with these, the psychedelic past and origins of our species. I think there's things that we can learn from what used to be a very common part of our existence as a species on this planet, is partaking of these sacred plants and having transcendent experiences. And also I have this legal disclaimer here that I'll read out loud for the recording. This presentation is not an encouragement or endorsement of doing anything illegal, including using prohibited substances. I may tell personal experiences that either myself or other people have had using illegal drugs. This is meant to be purely illustrative. And these stories should in no way be considered actual events or an admission of criminal activity. Like Alex Jones, I'm simply playing a character for the purposes of conveying certain aspects of the transcendent experiences that I will be explaining. So, we all on the same page? Okay. All right. So, I'm hoping to have some time to talk quite a bit about the entheogenic theory of religion. In case I'm not able to explore it too much later in the presentation, I know it's the topic of the presentation, but I really just want to talk about drugs, okay? But the premise of the entheogenic theory is that before agriculture, we as a species almost universally lived in small groups of hunter-gatherer villages and tribes and things like that. And the only religion that existed before agriculture was shamanic spiritual practices. And I'll talk a little bit more about what that means, with what shamanism means and what a shaman does. But part of it includes in certain cultures administering psychedelic plants to people while they participate in group religious rituals. All of these societies, most of these societies and groups were goddess worshippers. Male deities were very rare before agriculture came around. And but as agriculture was introduced, things like hierarchy, patriarchy, property, commerce, those things kind of shifted, and the use of the shamanic plants kind of phased out. They never went away. They've always been with us. But, you know, that shift in human civilization and human culture was possibly why the shamanic plants disappeared, because psychedelics are always a threat to hierarchies and patriarchies. And if you're a priest, you don't want people to be able to have their own connection. You got to work through me first, right? That's how it works. That's the difference between a priest and a shaman. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. And so, but what happened theoretically is that once the plants were phased out, all that was left over was the actual rituals and spiritual practices. And so the theory is that things like Hindu yogic meditation is a leftover vestige of what people would do to improve their psychedelic trips as they were engaging in shamanic rituals, right? And so things like sacraments and prayer and meditation and things like that. Okay, so that's a brief overview of what the entheogenic theory is about. But before, in order to really understand why the plants are significant, we really need to spend, I think, quite a bit of time making sure everybody's on the same page in terms of what a psychedelic is, What are psychedelics compared to other drugs? Are they harmful? Are they addictive? And what is a psychedelic experience? Like, what actually happens and why? And so I think laying that groundwork will help understand, you know, how significant and important these plants were to our ancestors, okay? So before we get into the nitty-gritty of the entheogenic theory, we're going to talk about some other things first. First, let's talk about drugs. What are drugs? I mean, drugs is like, it's this loaded word that means so much, so many different things to so many different people. For example, we all know that we are currently waging a war on drugs. Drugs are so bad that we have to literally wage war on stopping people from having them. But at the same time, we go to a doctor to get drugs. It's interesting. And we as a species, you know, have created a $1 trillion industry in the researching, synthesizing, manufacturing, and selling of drugs. It's one of the biggest industries on the planet. And then, of course, we take in all kinds of drugs throughout our lives. Some that don't even have a legal status at all, like caffeine is a drug. Sugar is a drug. Alcohol, of course, is a drug, right? A drug is anything that alters, you know, the systems of your body, whether it's something like a Tylenol. Tylenol is a drug. Caffeine is a stimulant, right? And obviously, we can sort of measure and understand what these drugs do and whether they're beneficial for people or they're harmful for people. And so it gets kind of confusing when you start talking about things like psychedelics, because especially if you're like me and grew up Mormon, you know, psychedelics, and they do legally get lumped in with other harmful, with actual harmful drugs like opiates and amphetamines and, you know, things that, you know, we know as a society can really not be good for you, good for your body or your brain. Same thing with alcohol too, right? Anyway, so there's a lot of kind of long, kind of weird words that I'm using, like the word entheogen. What in the world is an entheogen? So I want to kind of go through and explain what an entheogen is. I have a Venn diagram that my friend David was just going to love back there. Show him your tattoo, David. Guy loves Venn diagrams. That's all I'm saying. Okay. So, an entheogen is a chemical substance, typically a plant origin, that is ingested to produce a non-ordinary state of consciousness for religious or spiritual purposes. Okay? And so, there are lots of different kinds of entheogens. People don't realize it, but sacramental wine is an entheogen. Fits the definition. It's a mind-altering substance that's used in a spiritual or religious practice. In these images here, the one on the right is a peyote button from the peyote cactus, and which most of us are familiar. The indigenous tribes of North America use ceremonially, shamanically, and have for as far back as we know. And then the guy at the bottom is an ayahuasca darro. He's an ayahuasca shaman. I'll talk a little bit about ayahuasca later. But ayahuasca is the most potent psychedelic that we know of, and it is consumed. It is still to this day consumed ritualistically by hunter-gatherer tribes in the Amazon. So that's what an entheogen is: anything that is mind-altering that you use in a setting of a spiritual and religious practice. So what's a psychedelic then, right? And how are psychedelics different than other drugs? So a psychedelic is a drug that produces hallucinations and apparent expansions of consciousness. It's not really a very clear definition, right? But, and a lot of people get confused when they hear the word hallucination. And I'll talk a little bit more when I go through the psychedelic experience and what actually happens to your brain and what you see and what you experience. It's not a hallucination usually in the sense of, oh, I see a turtle walking down the carpet right here. But that carpet will definitely be moving. and you guys would look really cool right now, and I would look at the lines on these blinds, and it would be wiggling and things like that. So the hallucinations are not, specifically with the shamanic psychedelics that I'm going to be talking about, are not the conjuring of imaginary things, but that does happen when you close your eyes on psychedelics. You see things. In the pictures here, there's a sheet of stormtrooper acid, LSD, and you can see there it's taken typically LSD comes in tabs, and you put it on your tongue, and that's how it gets into your system. There are psilocybic mushrooms in the top right corner there, and the bottom right corner is a batch of ayahuasca that is being brewed. All right, so this is not a scientific, take all this with a grain of salt. This is just for demonstration purposes. So in this Venn diagram, you've got the big circle, which is all drugs. And obviously there's way, 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 way more drugs than I've listed out here. And then there is a circle with psychedelics, meaning these drugs that have you, that the hallucinogens that provide the transcendent mystical experience. And then the green circle is entheogens. And so the ones in the middle are substances that are both psychedelic and also used as entheogens traditionally. And so the term I've kind of come up for them is the shamanic entheogens, the psychedelics that are used, or the shamanic psychedelics, I guess is what you could call them. And so I don't know if any of you can read what these things say, but the substances I'm going to be mostly focusing on are mescaline, which is the psychoactive chemical in certain cacti, including the peyote cactus, psilocybin, which is the magic ingredient in magic mushrooms, DMT, which is dimethyltryptamine, and that is the active ingredient in ayahuasca, and then also cannabis, opium. Those are psychedelics that are also used as entheogens. And when I say cannabis, I'm really more talking about edible cannabis than inhalant cannabis. I'll explain that a little bit more later. So, this is my favorite part. This is going to be the best part. I do not really have a good sense of how long this is all taking. Oh, wow, I've already done 20 minutes. Holy cow, wow. All right, time flies when you're having fun. Okay. So I want to make a plug for a movie that if any of this interests you at all, if you're kind of curious about it, there's a great documentary called Neurons to Nirvana. The only place you can watch it right now is Amazon Prime. It used to be on Netflix. Don't fall for it's not on YouTube. Don't even try like I tried. It's not available. So if you got Amazon Prime, you can watch Neurons to Nirvana. And a lot of the information I'm going to present to you is stuff that you will learn from watching this video, and I even have a clip from it from the documentary that I'll play in a little bit here. So here is kind of a list of the common. I've included some of the non-shamanic psychedelics just because people are very familiar with them, things like LSD or MDMA or ecstasy. And so we'll talk a little bit about those. But I just kind of want to give an overview of what each of these are and kind of where they come from, how they're derived, what we know about them a little bit. And then we'll start talking about what actually happens when you ingest these substances, when you consume these substances. Okay. LSD-25, also known as acid, or LSD for short. And I don't even know if I can say this. Lysergic acid does anybody know how to say that? Thank you. There you go. So, LSD, I'll kind of go over the history in a little bit, but I wanted to kind of give you more of a close-up of what acid tabs look like. And so the LSD gets synthesized and derived from ergot. And ergot is a fungus that grows typically on rye seeds. and on rye grain. And it's incredibly toxic. But that's where LSD comes from. And it was discovered. I'll show you this again real quick. So anyway, it's incredibly potent. Oh, shoot. Oh, no. Okay. So it's incredibly potent, and it's dosed out in micrograms or gamma. Like, that's how little that you have. And 100 micrograms is considered a traditional dose of LSD. And so because it's so potent, they put it on this blotter paper, and then it perforates off, and then one tab is usually a single dose. Okay, so that's how you, if you were, of course, none of you would ever do that because it's illegal, but if you did, that's traditionally how acid is consumed. So it was discovered by this gentleman, Albert Hofmann, who in the world of psychedelia is one of the greatest legends ever, the man who discovered LSD. And Albert Hofmann was a chemist for Sandoz Laboratories in Switzerland. Is that right? I think so. Sweden? Switzerland? Okay, cool. So anyway, he was testing different derivatives of the LSD acid. And the LSD 25 is the 25th variant that he made. And he synthesized it in 1938, but then World War II just took off. I think he actually left Switzerland. But before, the thing that he thought was strange is when he tested it on rats, they just acted really weird. And he was just like, oh. And like, he wasn't trying to develop any kind of pharmaceutical. I can't even remember why he was testing all these different acids. Do you know? Yeah.
He was actually trying to find a cure for migraine.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Yeah. And by the way, Bryce, and I'm sorry, I already forgot your first name. Cody gave a great presentation earlier today about psychedelics and Mormonism. They did a really good job. So these guys know what they're talking about, so they can help me out because I don't know what I'm talking about most of the time. So anyway, he saw the rats acting weird after he administered the LSD to them, and then he just kind of like forgot about it. And then the war happened, and 5 years later or whatever, he's back in the lab, and he's like, oh, yeah. Remember that weird stuff that made that rats act weird? And I believe it was April 16th of 1943, he was riding his bicycle home, and all of a sudden just started tripping balls, just totally, you know, tripping. And he's like, what is happening? And so he thought he was like dying. He thought he'd been poisoned by something. And as his trip started, he just started wondering, like, well, what, how did I get it on me? Like, and he, I mean, honestly, he probably got a little tiny bit like on his finger or something. And that's all it took to get into his system and make him start tripping, right? And so that day is known as Bicycle Day in psychedelia. So actually, I think it was like he like accidentally ingested it like on April 16th, but then April 19th is Bicycle Day because that's the day that he was riding his bike back from work and it happened. Anyway, so that's who Albert Hofmann is. Just an important little fun fact, somebody you should know about. Magic mushrooms. There are, I don't even know how many dozens of psilocybic mushroom strains there are, but they grow all over the world and is probably one of the earliest entheogens that we ever used. The funny thing about a lot of these plants is almost all mammals, when they can figure out how to use these plants, they do it. They use it. They trip on it. And that's probably how we learned it, from watching them. In fact, I'll tell you a story about that I heard on a podcast with Dennis McKenna. I'll explain Dennis McKenna is later, but mescaline. So mescaline is the ingredient in the peyote cactus, and then DMT, dimethyltryptamine, is the ingredient in ayahuasca, which is this tree bark tea that the indigenous people in the Amazon consume ritualistically with shaman. And the thing that's so crazy about ayahuasca, check this out. Like, okay, this is, okay, bear with me here. So DMT is one of the building blocks of all life on Earth. DMT is in everything. You got a ton of endogenous DMT as opposed to endogenous? Okay, anyway. It's in your brain. It's just there, you know? And plants, most plants have quite a bit of DMT in them. But what's interesting is when you digest DMT, it breaks down in your digestive system immediately and doesn't do anything. And if your body didn't do that, you'd be eating a salad and start being like, whoa, you know, like, and so DMT gets destroyed in your system and has no effects because it gets neutralized, unless it has an MAO inhibitor. And I don't even know what MAO means, but I know that the MAO inhibitor allows your body to digest the DMT. And then it has its, once it gets into your, that's what allows it to hit your bloodstream and get into your brain. And so the DMT is heavily concentrated in the tree bark of this tree that they extract it from. But without the MAO inhibitor, it wouldn't do anything. And so there's this vine that has the MAO inhibitor in it. And they figured out to brew them together so that it will get through your system and let you trip. That is amazing technology. Like, how did they figure that out? Anyway, so one of the ways that they think they discovered the vine, this is what I was going to say earlier, is the indigenous people there say they see all the time the jaguars munching on the vine, like catnip. And that's how they became interested in it. And how they kind of figured out to mix it with the tree bark, who knows, man. But these people, we have no idea how long they've been using the psychedelic technology, but it seems like it's just something they've always done since they've been there. Thousands and thousands of years. Anyway, DMT is the most potent of all the psychedelics. And what's interesting is when you drink the ayahuasca tea, it causes you to violently vomit. It feels awful. Often the experience is not very pleasant, but the change that it does to you, and I haven't done ayahuasca, but the change that it does to you is very remarkable. But you can use DMT by itself. If you extract it from whatever plant you're getting it from, you can smoke it and have a DMT trip. But it only lasts like 5-10 minutes. It's crazy. Most psychedelics last hours and hours and hours and hours. But a DMT trip, they call it the executive's psychedelic, because you could, like, do it on your lunch break, you know? And so, anyway, it's kind of interesting. DMT, when it's inhaled like that, when it's vaporized, combusted, and inhaled, it only lasts in your system. It's like a flash in the pan. But when you ingest it, when you eat it with the MAO inhibitor, the trip lasts several hours. So that's kind of interesting. And I really love this image here. Can you guys read that? Maybe she's born with it. Maybe it's dimethyltryptamine. She's putting mascara on her third eye. Come on, that's great. All right. Okay. The reason I want to talk about MDMA is it's a very stigmatized drug. You know, I still remember watching that episode of Oprah when she showed the brain scans with the holes in the scan, that ecstasy puts holes in your brain. I'm like, oh my goodness. And like, I'm like 12 years old, freaking out, like, whoa. Why would people do that? So this is a very stigmatized drug, and it can be abused, certainly. It's a very popular party drug that people use at raves. It's an amazing amount of fun. But what's interesting about MDMA is it totally feeds off your serotonin. When you roll ecstasy or Molly, you basically drain all the serotonin in your body. And if you're not careful, you crash afterwards, and it's really bad. But here's what's fascinating about MDMA is right now they are currently entering, is it phase 3 or stage 3? Stage 3 clinical trials for using MDMA to treat PTSD. And so here's what's crazy. So these patients, the subjects that are participating in the MDMA clinical trials right now, They are sexual abuse survivors, combat veterans, people who have failed all of the traditional modalities of treatment for PTSD. Medication, therapy, nothing works, right? So these are people who are just desperate. And the MDMA, by the time they're done with their therapy, which takes, I think, a couple months for them to do all the sessions that they want to do, after 2 months, 85% success rate in not just treating the symptoms of the PTSD and getting it managed, curing it. These people are taking the same diagnostic questionnaire that they took before they started the study, and they no longer qualify for the diagnosis of PTSD. 85%. That was from stage two of the trials. Double blind, legit. Anyway, it's magical, and it's illegal. Can't do anything with it. Schedule one substance. It's insane. Okay, cannabis is kind of an honorable mention in this category because when you smoke weed, it's obviously you get high. Everybody knows that. But usually it's only when you ingest it that you're going to have what would probably be powerful enough to be called a psychedelic experience. And the oldest form of that is hashish, which is basically where all the resin from the plant gets. I don't even know how they make hashish, but anyway, they make it into these bricks that you can see here. That's all like cannabis resin, and then they just eat it, and you know, off to the races after that. So this part's fun. How am I doing on time? Okay, good. So all the different psychedelics I've shown you. If I was to do a Venn diagram again, David, they would all overlap quite a bit, with the exception of MDMA. MDMA is a little bit different. But LSD, mushrooms, peyote, there is a lot of similarities of what happens in the psychedelic experience. There's a lot of common threads. And most of it, not most of it, I mean, each one has its own unique qualities, but they all kind of provide a similar kind of experience, just like different flavors. And here is, now with modern technology and fMRI scans, we can get people acid, throw them in an fMRI machine, and understand exactly what's happening, and that's what I'm going to show you here, all right? So this first diagram, and I know it's really like pixelated, but this is a blood flow measurement. And the areas that are blue are areas where there is decreased blood flow in those parts of the brain. And this actually surprised the researchers that were conducting this study. They thought it would be like, they thought it was just going to be like a rush to the head of blood. But what actually happens when you take these psychedelics, this is psilocybin, I believe. That's the substance that you're seeing here. But they all do this. They all do this. And what happens is your prefrontal cortex is like the information processor for all of the data that's coming from your senses. Everything but your nose, I think, goes through your prefrontal cortex. So everything you're seeing, hearing, tasting, you know, all that stuff, touching, all that stuff gets processed through your prefrontal cortex. And the prefrontal cortex, it's kind of like video compression software. Like anytime you're streaming a movie on Netflix, that full resolution video has been run through what's called a codec, a compression codec, that basically removes bits of information that will still give you, you know, a good amount of quality, but allow you to stream faster. And what our prefrontal cortex does is it helps us really focus on the things that we need to just do the crap that we need to do throughout the day. What happens is when you decrease blood flow to the prefrontal cortex, that information spreads out and gets processed by different parts of the brain that normally don't have anything to do with it. And here's what that looks like. So on the top is the placebo brain. And so this is just normal waking consciousness. What your brain activity looks like. And then this is what happens to those regions when it's when the brain has LSD in the system. Pretty fascinating. So what happens is now instead of, you know, it's, I keep trying to think of a good analogy for this, but basically parts of your brain that normally don't talk to each other are talking to each other. And that, we still don't fully understand how all that works. We're learning more, like there's so much research happening right now, it's incredible, of exactly how these different substances work on your brain and create these visionary experiences, these trips. So that's how these drugs work. This is your brain on drugs. So the psychedelic experience is often called a trip. And everybody's heard that, you know, oh, that guy, he must be tripping, you know, whatever. But trip is just, like I said, another word for the transcendent experience that you have when you take a psychedelic. And it's kind of like a ladder. And at the top of the ladder is what's called, is often referred to as an ego death. And whatever crazy stuff that these chemicals are doing in your brain, the effect that it has is it slowly removes you and gives you distance between you and your ego. And what do I mean by your ego? Your ego, the way I'm going to use the word, is that thing that is I, you, me. It's that thing that's sitting about 2 inches behind your eyes right now looking up here at me, that's hearing me talk and thinking about it and processing it. It's the thing that you think about when you're like, oh, I'm not good enough, or oh, I did great. You know, that thing, that's your ego, right? And what a lot of experts who study psychedelics, especially in a therapeutic setting, or people who guide psychedelic trips, the deeper you get into the psychedelic trip, it goes through kind of 5 levels, is kind of how they categorize it. And so a level 1 or level 2, level 5 is the ego death. And I'll try to explain what that is in just a second. But basically, as you go up in these levels, the more distance you get between you and that thing that's sitting 2 inches behind your eyes. And so like if you did a small amount of a psychedelic, you could expect to have a level 1 or level 2 trip, which is something that would be arguably recreational. You know, you could go explore a city, you could go to a party, hang out with friends, you know, probably shouldn't drive, but, you know, it's a very moderate effect. Once you get into level 3 and level 4 and level 5, what happens in the psychedelic experience is there is what's called a peak. And the peak is where the transcendent visions happen. And usually, depending on the drug that you're taking, like mushrooms, you can expect a 1.5 to 2.5 hour come up, a 1.5 to 2 hour peak, and then a 2 or 3 hour come down. LSD is longer. You can expect anywhere between 8 and 12 hours, or sometimes even longer. Mescaline is pretty similar to that. Ayahuasca lasts 5 or 6 hours, I believe. And so. Once you get into these higher doses of the psychedelic, you start to have this peak experience. And that's where there's potential for an ego death to happen. And level 3 and level 4 trips are good for like processing trauma, for solving problems, either in your career or, like, for example, fun fact, the scientist that discovered or conceptualize the three-dimensional double helix structure of the DNA strand, he had that epiphany during an acid trip. And so I would say that's probably like a level 3 trip. He experienced that. So what is level 5? What is this ego death? Like, what are we talking about? And so here's how I like to explain it. That thing that's sitting 2 inches behind your eyes, that sense of you, what if that just slowly just like disappeared, like sand being blown off of a table. Like it just slowly dissolves and melts away. What would be left? What would be on the other side of that? And the answer is everything. Everything. The universe. Who knew? The universe is just sitting inside your head this whole time. But that's what an ego death is. You melt into God or the universe or whatever you want to call it. And everything, you just become one. And it's the most blissful and satisfying and awesome. Not awesome like awesome, dude. Like literally awesome. Just complete, full of awe and wonder. And then you come back from it, and, you know, you slowly come back, and you find your ego again, but you don't come back the same. You don't come back the same, usually. So that's sort of what's happening when you're tripping. That's what your ego is going through. And the deeper your trip is, the more you're going to disassociate with your ego. And the reason it's so therapeutic is because you're getting distance from your pain. You're getting distance from the trauma. You're getting distance from the memories so that you can actually face them and process them. And it's amazing that the plants actually give you that experience sometimes. I did 2 years of therapy the first time I did mushrooms in the space of 2 hours. It was the most life-changing experience that I've ever had. Nothing has been the same since that happened to me, allegedly. So I want to talk about the hallucinations. How are we doing on time now? Maybe I am going to take up this whole hour and a half. Sorry, guys. Is everybody doing good? Is this interesting? Okay. All right. So the hallucinations are sometimes called visuals. In fact, most psychonauts, vocabulary word, remember that. One of the coolest words I've ever heard, a psychonaut, somebody who explores their inner universe. The visuals come in sort of two forms. There are the open-eyed visuals that you see as you're looking out in the world, and then there's the visuals that happen when your eyes are closed, and they're different. And so I don't know how well these videos are going to work because they weren't working very well earlier, and I'm worried it's going to blast a bunch of sound. But so this is an example kind of what it looks like, what open-eyed visuals look like. So you'll look at, like I was saying earlier, you'll look at a wall, and you'll see the wall kind of move a little bit. It's kind of dancing for you. And, you know, if you looked at a cat like this, it would just be a little bit, you know, kind of ripply and wavy. And it's beautiful. Oh, shoot, I left the whole thing. There we go. It's remarkably beautiful. And you experience these visuals throughout the whole trip, but on the come up, it's like the really fun part because it's before your peak happens and it's more just kind of satisfying and pleasurable. And if you're with people, you just sit around and laugh and have a good time and, you know, crack each other up, listen to great music. It's great. And then here is an example. Okay, this one has sound, so I'm kind of worried. Oh, there you go. So this is somebody trying to make a visual representation of what the closed-eyed visuals look like. And I'm sorry, is that working at all? It's not working. It's not going to happen. And that music sounds horrifying. Okay, you hear the term fractals. And you know what? Hey, sit tight with me real quick. Let's try something. Everybody give a round of applause for Andre for saving the day. All right. Oh, dear. We're seeing some nudity at Sunstone. That probably has happened many times before. So here's the thing. Anybody know what the word ineffable means? Here's the crazy thing about these experiences. A lot of the stuff you experience, you can't take back with you. Like, there's just no way for your mind to process what you see when you're in this normal state of consciousness. It's just indescribable. And the visuals, like, yeah, this is kind of what it feels like and looks like, but not really. You know, it's just, I'll look through some of these. Anybody, any of this look familiar to anybody here? So, like, I've seen stuff that looks like this. Portals and swirling weird, I don't know, it's weird. Like, why? It's like, it looks amazing. So that's kind of what the closed-eyed visuals look like. And then during your peak, those closed-eyed visuals will turn into visions. And I should go back to my presentation because that's kind of what I'm talking about next here. Oh, this looks so much better. Thank goodness. Okay. So, talked about the trauma processing. Theophanies. This is where we start talking about the goddesses, okay? As the title suggests. So, a theophany is when you have a visitation with a deity. And almost every single time I've tripped, I interact with goddesses. Sometimes it's just one. Sometimes it's hundreds of them. Hundreds and hundreds of them. And I don't understand why. Like, I don't know where that comes from. Because I'm an atheist. I don't really care about goddesses at all. But it's very common for people to experience deities in these psychedelic visions. And it's a very common thread. The deities will look different, probably depending on where you're from and how you grew up and what your sort of gestalt is or whatever. And so, but interacting with otherworldly beings, something like we're on DMT, people talk about the little green aliens you see all the time. Like, it's weird. Why are there little green aliens? Like little green elves sometimes. It's weird. Just like a near-death experience, it's very common for people to have life reviews, you know, where you kind of, what do they say, your life flashes before your eyes. For me, definitely lots of memories, you know, you relive different memories. Trauma processing, you know. There's a trip that I had where I saw all of the anger and hate and pain in my that I carry around with me, and I saw it inside me, and it looked like these tumors. And I remember my hands turned into like little needles, and I just went in and I just picked them apart and figured out what it was all made of and processed all that. And it was remarkable, truly remarkable. One of the most common things that happens to me when I'm tripping is I interact with my friends, with the people closest to me in my life. My friend David and Andre back there, there was one trip I had where everybody I knew were animals, and the three of us were bears, like little buddy bears hanging out with each other, doing bear stuff together, having a good time. Really weird. And then when you get close to an ego death, it's like you're on this, especially on mushrooms, like it's like this roller coaster through the cosmos. Like it's not like you're seeing space, but you're just seeing all of this existence. Anyway, so here's why this is important. If we do ever get to the whole entheogenic theory of religion part, like that's why it's so compelling. The theory is, to me, as someone who has experienced these goddesses and somebody who has had these amazing, I mean, you gotta understand, people, I went through a divorce a year and a half ago. I was suicidal. I was on antidepressants. They weren't doing anything. I spent 3 months getting off the antidepressants because the thing is, if you're on SSRIs, there's a ceiling to how deep you can go on your trip. And I had tried it and didn't get what I wanted out of it. So I got off my meds for 3 months. And I was like, okay, I'm going to try mushrooms, I'm going to try acid, I'm going to try this, and then I'm going to get back on the drugs, because I can't live without those drugs, you know? And so I did this big mushroom trip. It was 24th of July, Pioneer Day. I went on a trek in my own mind. And that was over a year ago, and I don't need the meds. I just need a trip every once in a while. I'm great. Brain medicine. Telling you, people, this is in no way an endorsement of doing anything that's illegal or trying any of these. So if you really want to know, I saw this image while I was recently, like, if you want to know what a psychedelic trip feels like, it feels like that right there. Like, that is it. A deep psychedelic trip. See, I have this video. I don't know if it's going to work. This is Aldous Huxley talking about his trips. I don't know if it'll work. Sunstone! Why isn't my video working? Okay. I only talk to them when I'm tripping, man. Talk to them otherwise.
Well, of course, as all the patients say to describe it, there are the colors and the beauties, the designs, the beautiful way things appear. People themselves, dull people that I thought dull, appear fascinating, interesting, mysterious, wonderful. But that's only the beginning. Suddenly you notice that there aren't these separations, that we're not on a separate island shouting across to somebody else and trying to hear what they're saying and misunderstanding. This thing's flowing underneath. We're parts of a single continent. It meets underneath the water. And with that goes such delight, the sober certainty of waking bliss.
I love that, the sober certainty of waking bliss. He just said it was a really good time. Yeah. Aldous Huxley, famous British philosopher, writer, got really into...
Brave New World.
Yeah, Brave New World, author of Brave New World. Mm-hmm. All right. So, how are we doing on time now? I'm almost at my hour. All right. So, we'll burn through the rest of this really quick. That's why I kind of gave a summary of the entheogenic theory. Let me just, okay. So, here's just some of the different entheogens that we have evidence of. A lot of these are, you know, post-agriculture. Like I said, these psychedelics didn't go away, but they did, you know, and like, look at the drug war. You want to talk about, you don't think psychedelics are a threat to hierarchies? Like, look at the drug war. They're scared out of their minds of it. Because if you have an experience that connects you to everything in the universe, it's kind of hard to hate each other. It's harder to divide people. It's harder to get them to fight each other. It's harder, you know. And so these things are always threats to hierarchies. So this is Africa. Iboga is a very popular psychedelic that's used. I have a friend that tried it once and had a crazy trip. Here in the Americas, some of the oldest psychedelics that we have evidence of are the Olmecs, which are, I think they were like pre-Aztec, like in the same, yeah, the Jaredites. That, the Jaredites did mushrooms, everybody. So they have these, they find these mushroom statues everywhere. You know, these, there are hundreds and hundreds and thousands of them. The Maya used tobacco, salvia, mushrooms, and morning glory flowers. The Aztecs were fans of the peyote, jimson weed. I don't even, yeah, half this stuff, I don't even know what it is either, sorry. And of course, we know the Native American tribes that they use tobacco and peyote ceremonially. In South America, the Peruvian torch cactus, which is also a close cousin of the San Pedro cactus. I don't know if I should say this, but the San Pedro cactus you can buy at Home Depot. Just saying. Can't buy peyote anywhere, but you can buy San Pedro. I'm just saying. But the Peruvian torch cactus, they would use coca, which is what cocaine is derived from. And then, of course, the ayahuasca. Cannabis, kratom, opium, Syrian rue, popular entheogens historically in Asia and Middle East. Europe, alcohol. And they also used, you know, like the Germanic tribes used cannabis and mushrooms shamanically. So, just to kind of wrap things up, there's this great book you all should check out. That's where I got most of this information from. But Terence McKenna is the godfather of psychedelia. He and his brother Dennis, who's still alive, they were like some of the first white people to go into the Amazon and say, hey, what's this stuff we keep hearing about? And one of the first people to consume the ayahuasca. Terrence's brother Dennis has done DMT over 500 times. He spent more time in that headspace than any human being alive. And his brother Terrence wrote this book called The Food of the Gods. And there's a lot of weird, wonky theories in it. Like this whole entheogenic theory of religion, like it's highly speculative. It's impossible for us to have evidence, you know. But basically what Terence McKenna says is, and I know I'm kind of repeating myself a little bit, but he makes a distinction between partnership societies and dominator societies. The societies that existed before agriculture were typically partnership societies, where, from what we can tell through the study of anthropology, these were societies where there was at least pretty close to good gender egalitarianism. And like I said, they were goddess worshippers. And their religion was shamanism. And a shaman, you know, is somebody who's there as a guide to help you have this transcendent connection to God, to the universe. That's one of their jobs. Shamans are also healers, usually. They're there to give, like, advice and stuff. You know, they're kind of the spiritual center of the village. But they're not there for you to work through them. They're there to help you get there on your own. And not all shamanic cultures use entheogens. Some of them don't use them at all. And sometimes the shamans are the only ones that take the drug. But often, like when you do the ayahuasca darro, he drinks it with you. And they also use tobacco during the ceremony, like smokes tobacco and blows it in your face and stuff. It's crazy. But once agriculture showed up, everything switched to dominator societies, which are usually run by patriarchies. And that is when, like I said earlier, we find the introduction of property, territory. You know, you're not just moving around and, you know, living off the land anymore. You got your turf, right? And that means we have to have rules and boundaries. And that's when we end up having currencies and money and economies and markets. And the idea of owning something, possessing something, something, you know, this laptop is mine, you know. That all happens after agriculture shows up. And there's a great book you should all read called Sapiens. It makes a great argument for why agriculture was like one of the worst things that ever happened to us. That's in Sapiens, right? Yeah. So the key to this theory is that yoga, for example, basically the theory is that the shamans discovered techniques, things that you could do with your body to enhance the psychedelic experience. And this has happened to me, like on accident. I found something crazy out just on accident. So I was tripping, maybe, allegedly, and I found myself in this pyramid, this empty pyramid, but the pyramid was made of like hundreds and hundreds of goddesses. And it was like the most powerful religious experience of my life. And I was listening to this really cool Hindu yogic chanting music. And I started trying to sing along to it. And the words are Om Namah Shivaya. Om Namah Shivaya, Shivaya. And so I started like trying to sing along, but I was like tripping so much I couldn't really do it. So finally I just started humming to it, and I made the Om. And I went Om. And all of a sudden, when my, just that act of doing the Om, that vibration, it felt like it turned me into a freaking antenna. Like I was just like, boom, it just took it to another level. It was crazy. And I'd like do that all the time now. It's great. And so that's the idea, that people stumbled on little tricks to improve their trips, their shamanic experiences, and the rituals developed around those techniques, right? And so Johns Hopkins University, they've been doing research on psilocybin, on magic mushrooms, for over 10 years now. And with one of their studies, they took, how am I doing on time? Okay. In one of their studies, they took two groups, and all of their subjects had little or no experience with spiritual practices like meditation and yoga and stuff like that. And then they split the group in half, gave one half 5 hours of like meditation training or spiritual practice training, yoga, something like that. The other group got 35 hours. And then it was a double-blind study, so half of each group got, some people got placebo, some people actually got the mushrooms. And when you compared the group that had 5 hours of training and got the psilocybin, how they rate their experience is, of course, amazing, right? But the group that got the 35 hours ranked it much, much higher. Much higher in terms of the power and the potency of the experience and what they got out of it. And so that's like really good data there, right? And so the idea is that as shamanism got phased out, the entheogens got phased out, but guess what was left over? The spiritual practices. And instead of those spiritual practices being used by shaman, we see the introduction of priests. And like I was saying earlier, the priest wants you to have an experience, but it needs to be connected to him or her, right? You got to work through her. And that's where religion comes from. Hey, that's it. That's the entheogenic theory of religion in a nutshell. So, obviously, I wanted to mostly talk about psychedelics. I'm not really good at this Sunstone thing. I'm not like an academic. I don't know how to I'm not good at citing my sources or anything like that. But, these plants are meant for us. And this is something I say a lot to people is, and I learned this from this documentary, Neurons to Nirvana, from Dennis McKenna, the guy I was just telling you about. Dennis McKenna says this all the time. He's like, the way animals mediate their relationships with their environment is through their behavior. So, like us, the way we get the things that we need is we go out and we I'm going to drive to work and, go to work and get money and then I can buy food, And, the way you interact with other animals is through your behavior, the things that you do, the noises you make with your mouth. But the way plants mediate their relationships is through chemistry. That's all they can do. And so, like cannabis is a really good example. Like, we have this, natural endocannabinoid system that all mammals have. And you have this plant that for some crazy reason just has an enormous amount of cannabinoids that get mammals high. Like, and that is a symbiotic relationship. And if you want to make it even a little bit even more wonky and weird, another thing that Dennis McKenna says all the time is that, whatever you want to call it, Mother Nature or Gaia, the balance of the ecosystem of our planet, the way it communicates with us is through chemistry. That's how we get our nutrients. That's how we get our medicine. And this is like the Amazonian people, when they do the ayahuasca, guess what they call it? We're going to go learn from the forest. We're going to be taught by the forest. And so, that all kind of ties into this whole thing. And so we have always consumed these. You go to these caves that they find in like France that have been undisturbed for like 40,000 years, and they got these trippy cave paintings all over the walls. Guess what you find in the paint? Entheogens. They find it on the ground, on the floor. We've always done this. It's a part of who we are. And arguably, how our species developed is through using these plants. And so, it's our birthright. It belongs to us, if you're going to use that word, belong. But it's meant for us. And I think it's something that we've lost, especially in modern Western culture. Because if you're killing your ego on a regular basis, it's much, much harder to sweat the small stuff. I will wrap up my presentation with that. Thank you. Yeah, now would love to take whatever rest of our time we want for Q&A. We got 20 minutes.
So I don't think this cord is long enough to do fasting testimony style. So we'll have to come up here to the mic if you have questions.
Yeah, see if you can move it, go out that way a little bit further.
I'm wondering, I'm not clear, why did the introduction of agricultural practices lead them away from an egalitarian society to a patriarchal warmongering society? What happened that occurred? Why did they give that something that was so good up?
I don't know. Not an expert at all on that. But who doesn't like stuff? I like my stuff. I like my things. I like my house. It belongs to me. And in order for it to stay mine, what do I need to do? I need to preserve my interests. And how am I going to do that? I'm going to do that through putting a fence around my property. I'm going to lock up my possessions. And that's the difference between a partnership society and a dominator society. It doesn't mean we're all out to get each other, but sometimes we are. And that's what property and possession does to humans. Like, we know that. Like, we see it in ourselves all the time. And that's just kind of my kind of off the cuff response to that question. I don't know. I'm not as versed as I should be to really even be talking about this. But it's just what happens when there's hierarchies. And arguably, that's what you need. Well, the other thing that agricultural brought is an explosion of humans. Like, the global population for the first, 100,000 years we were around, or however long, was stayed pretty consistent, at least from what they can tell. I actually just read an article about this. I was searching to understand at what point there is more people, that the number of people alive outnumber the people who are dead. And so I found this great data about how they can see how global population remain pretty stagnant with like little ebbs and flows, and then exploded after agriculture. And when you got more people to worry about, more, you got to make more stuff, you've got to make more food, you've got to have more things, and it just explodes from there. And shamanism isn't going to fit into that environment. It doesn't. It's not compatible. Yeah.
I'm just wondering what drug you used that helped with your heart, how you like found it, or was it, did, I'm wondering what your story is, how you even felt safe to, or found a safe space to try this out so that you could have all these.
We can talk about best practices a little bit. I'd be okay with that. Is anybody interested in that?
Start by tweeting the fifth.
Yeah. Well, so, again, none of this is based on actual events. I would never do anything illegal like that. But, the thing that really turned me on to trying psychedelics was that documentary I shared with you, Neurons to Nirvana. It's just something that popped up on my next Netflix queue, and I was like, oh, that's weird, what's this? And it was just like, because I'd found weed. After I left the church, weed was really good for me. And so that broke up all kinds of stigmas for me. I'm like, okay, this stuff is amazing and good for me. And so what else are they lying to me about, basically? And then I watched this documentary and I was like, oh, wow. And so then it really was just reading books, doing a bunch of research. That's the wonderful thing is it's not the 70s anymore, All of the tools you need to do this stuff safely are right there at your fingertips on the internet. There's so many forums and websites and wikis and, more information than you can ever process about this stuff. That's actually kind of a double-edged sword because you got to, wade through a lot of nonsense to find the good information that you need. But I'm sorry, what was the rest of your question? Like, oh, that, okay, that trip gets even crazier. So that was, just LSD. Here's the thing, and everybody's different. Like, that's the other crazy thing, is different people get different things out of their trips. There's, like, no right or wrong way to do it, like, and you can't, go into a trip with expectations like, I want to address these issues and it better happen. Because you can have intentions but not expectations, because the plants don't always give you what you want, they give you what you need. And sometimes what you need is not pleasant to go through. And that's where we get into the concept of bad trips, right? And if we want, we can talk about bad trips a little bit. But this was definitely a bad trip I had. But it was good. So good for me. So going through and processing all of that anger and pain, it was awful because I was just reliving all of it and feeling it all, like all at the same time. And it made me, and I remember when it started, I was like, oh no. Oh, I already feel awful. This is just going to get worse. I remember thinking like there's different things you can do when you're tripping, like change rooms, change the music, you know, just kind of try to switch things up. And I was like, you know, I probably just need to trust it and see what it's going to show me. And so yeah, I saw these tumors inside me and I picked them all apart, all that pain, all that trauma, saw where it came from, memories like, oh yeah. And then once I processed that, the scope of it just started widening out. And it just got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. Where I wasn't just feeling my pain, I started feeling my children's pain, my friend's pain, my community. And it just got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger till I felt like I was experiencing all of the pain and suffering in the universe. And it was like, there are parts where I like felt like I blacked out from it. Like it was awful. It was like a Jesus moment. It's really weird. It sounds like really like kind of, I don't know, narcissistic or whatever, but like that's the only thing I could compare it to. And it got so crazy that it just became meaningless. The pain got so great that it just became absolutely meaningless. And then it became beautiful. And one of the reasons it was so beautiful is because I remembered back to when I was just feeling mine. And I started laughing at how meaningless my pain and suffering is. And just how funny it is that I get so wrapped up in my pain. And so wrapped up in all the things that are going wrong in my life. And it's just like, it's nothing, you know? And so, yeah, that's what happened. That was a few months ago. any other questions? Okay, so let's say you wanted to make a really irresponsible decision and try some of these psychedelic medicines. Of course, you would probably go somewhere like Scandinavia where it's legal, where you could, you know, purchase it legally and consume it legally. Something I hope to do someday. That's right, Oregon. Everybody, let's go to Oregon. Sunstone. So there are three things to pay attention to when you are planning a psychedelic trip. Number one, dose. 100 micrograms of LSD is considered a moderate to kind of normal dose. What was that? 100 micrograms, 100 to 150 micrograms is usually normal, and it's not usually weight adjusted. Psilocybin is much, 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 much trickier. But what you always say is an eighth. You always hear people say an eighth of an ounce. Because here's the problem with the mushrooms: is they vary by potency so much. When they're dry, you're getting the dried mushrooms, and lots of things can happen along the way that can, like, you know, dilute the potency. But Johns Hopkins University has a weight adjusted dose of how many milligrams of psilocybin you should take per kilogram of body weight. But it's kind of hard to do that conversion when you're talking about dried mushrooms. But usually 3.5 grams is considered a full dose of mushrooms, somewhere between 2.5 and 3.5 grams. And then there's the hero dose, which is 5 grams. That's what that's called, the hero dose. So yeah, doses is important, and if you kind of know what you're going into it for, like, oh, I want to have a level 2 trip and just kind of hang out and chill, then maybe I'll just do like a quarter of a tab of acid or a gram of mushrooms or whatever, because I'm a big dude, you know? And so so dosage is important, and you can kind of dose based on what you want to get out of it. Like, I really want to have this ego death thing, you know, do a large dose, you know? But do your research. Research online. Like, I can't even believe I'm saying all this. This is so weird. The second thing is the last two are usually referred to as set and setting. Set referring to your mindset, and setting referring to the environment where you are doing the trip. So your mindset is, like I said, you don't want to have expectations. You want to have intentions. I showed up to guide somebody on a trip once, and this person was a complete mess, just not good. And I just said, I'm not doing this. You're not doing this. This is not the time for you to do this tonight. You know, you know, you want to do it when you... I'm not saying you got to feel great. A lot of times the reason you're taking it is because you don't feel great, you know? But, you know, being in a good state of mind. And then the setting is the environment, and that's one of the most important things, if not the most important thing. Ryan.
Yeah, talk about how you can't make a bad day.
What was that? Yeah, right.
They're not a cure.
See, here's the thing. Like, it's a door. You will process things and do work, and it will have immediate benefits. But it's not like I don't still hate my ex-wife, you know, like, whatever it is that you're dealing with, right? But it shows you the door. It shows you what you could feel like if you could just get rid of this stuff. It gives you a taste of it, yeah. Where you are located and who you are with. So it is always a good idea, especially if you're a rookie psychonaut trying it for your first time, to have a guide there. A guide doesn't necessarily need to be somebody who has tripped, but it's probably a good idea. The guide should be somebody that you have built trust with, and somebody... The primary purpose of the guide is to be there as an anchor so that you don't worry about your physical body. Because, like I said, these trips aren't all just fun and games. There's really great parts and really sad parts and really weird parts and strange parts and parts where you feel really paranoid and nervous. How are we doing on time? Good. And so, like, you will worry about what's going on in your world. And if you can have somebody there, it's like, no, I'm taking care of this. I'm taking care of all this. You just go have this experience and go on this journey. That's what a guide is there for. It's an anchor so that you don't have to worry about, you know, the paranoid stuff that you're going to worry about. You're going to worry about it no matter what, but the guide helps. And if you have somebody who's an experienced guide, you know, there's lots of, you know, tricks if things aren't going well. You know, the guide is there to help with, like, music and, you know. Anyway, so it's always good to have a guide, especially with your first experiences, when you're going to do a full dose. Now, if you wanted to try it for your first time and just do a half a gram of mushrooms or a quarter tab of LSD, you can just do that and you'll be fine. You know, it's not going to be an overwhelming experience. You don't want to like go drive a car or anything like that. If you're going to be home at night and kids are in bed, you know, microdose is what they call that. But if you're going to do a full dose, you want to have a guide, and you want to remove things that are going to stress you out. So yeah, if you're going to do a big mushroom trip, you don't want to have your kids around, for God's sakes. Like, the nightmare. You don't want to be on call with work. You don't want to, you know, you're going to want to, and you're going to want to have 8 hours of time at least blocked out where you can just not have anything going on. And when you're tripping, the more people there, the more risk you have of things not going well. The first time I tried mushrooms, allegedly, I was on my antidepressants, so they didn't work. And so I was like, oh, bummer. And there was like a party going on that night. I was like, oh, yeah, I wanted to go to that party tonight, but I can't because I was doing this, but this isn't working, so maybe I'll just go to this party. One thing I didn't know at the time is how cannabis interacts with psychedelics. And so I got to this part, and I was like, well, if I can't trip, I'm sure as hell getting high. And so cannabis is the nifty little tool to have when you're tripping. If it's not deep enough, smoke some weed. If it's tapering off and kind of you're kind of on your, going on your come down and you want to go back into it, smoke a bunch of weed. So I went to this party, this huge Exmo party, and there was all these people there, and I was having a great time, and I went out back, and I smoked some weed, and it was just like, and I was like, oh no, something's happening. And I found myself at this huge party, and I did not go deep. That was like a level 3 type of trip, but it was my first time ever experiencing anything like that. I immediately recognized, like, oh, this is what tripping is. And then I just got really, really scared. And there was so many people there. I thought I was like imagining people, but I wasn't. Like, it was too much. But then a good friend of mine helped me, took me downstairs, lied me down on a bed, put some music on, turned the lights off, and then I was good. But it could have gone much, much worse. So yeah, that's just an example of making sure that you are in control of your environment and your setting, so that way you can have the most success. All right, I think we'll wrap it up there. It's 6:27. Thanks for listening to me ramble for an hour and a half. I don't know how you got through that.